I'll speak about protected qubit using Josephson junctions, using superconductors. And superconductors are nice because one can build electric circuits out of them. And we know how to work with electric circuits. That's part of my motivation. I want to talk about protected qubits using superconductor devices. It won't be exactly topological protection, but simpler kind of protection. It can be viewed as topological protection in 1D. The goal is to find a set of basic elements for quantum electric circuits, and those electric elements must be protected so that all unwanted interactions be exponentially suppressed.
Sorry, what do you mean? I mean, but it does not mean protection for the qubit. Hmm.
Oh, protection for the qubit means that the qubit.
You only mean one. You mean to suppress that? Some introduction, if you don't want them, you suppress them. This doesn't mean you protect your qubit.
It means that when we don't want the qubit to perform any gate, we want it to stay intact. And so all the interactions will be suppressed. If we want to perform some gate, then there is a way to turn interactions off, on. But that will only be a certain kind of interaction that we want. Page down works. Here are some simple elements that are commonly used in superconducting circuits. A capacitor, well, it's just a capacitor, and a Josephson junction has this schematic notation, and it is characterized by two parameters. J is the Josephson energy. It has the dimension of energy, and if you consider the charge of an electron or the charge of a cupifer, to be one, it's also has the dimension of current. And each Josephson junction also has some intrinsic capacitance. In fact, it is not possible to get rid of that capacitance because a certain combination of J and C, which is called Josephson plasma frequency, is the property of the material, the superconductor itself and the insulator in the Josephson junction. And to have more flexibility, we also want to implement other elements. An inductor will be very useful for that qubit I'm going to discuss. And usually an inductor is implemented as a coil. And another way to implement an inductor is using a chain of Josephson junctions. In this chain, each Josephson junction has a strong coupling much greater than the Coulomb energy. You see that E squared over C is the charging energy of a capacitor when we put one electron on it. And the Josephson energy must be greater than this number. That is to prevent phase slips in the Josephson junctions. And if we have n such junctions, then the effective inductance is proportional to n, the number of junctions, to j to the minus 1, and there is some dimensional factor, which can be considered as one, as unit, in proper units, when the Planck constant is one and 2e is one. And later on, I'll show a different way of implementing an inductor, which is better than these implementations. Another very useful element is a switch. It sounds simple, but it's not so simple if you want this switch to be controlled by, say, magnetic field, electric field, external current, and so on. We don't want to actually switch it by hand. And this is one way to implement a switch. It's a chain of squids. A squid is a pair of Joseon junctions connected in parallel. And one puts some magnetic flux between those two Joseon junctions. So in each loop, there is some magnetic flux. And when there is magnetic flux, the currents through the two Joseon junctions interfere not completely constructively. The currents don't just add up. In fact, if the flux equals pi, they interfere destructively, and the whole chain becomes insulating. To actually achieve the superconductor insulator transition, one needs to take quantum fluctuations into account. But this has actually been implemented by Haviland and Cawthorne in 2000. This chain works as a switch. Again, I'll show you a different design of a switch. Let me discuss some more exotic elements or simple circuits. This circuit consists of four Joseon junctions, and there is a magnetic flux equal to pi through this loop. Here is a toy model for the whole circuit. The energy of this device depends on the phase difference between these two points. A superconductor is characterized by an order parameter that is called superconducting phase, and it varies from 0 to 2 pi. It's a cyclic variable. It is defined modulo 2 pi. Here the superconducting phase is phi 1, here there it's phi 2, and phi is the difference between the two phases. And the energy is mostly periodic with period pi. It's cosine 2 pi. But there is a small error term that is periodic with period 2 pi. In fact, period 2 pi is necessary due to the definition of this order parameter, because it's defined modulo 2 pi. But this device, if one does the calculation, mostly depends on phi modulo pi. There, a term comes about if the flux through the device is not exactly pi, but slightly different. No, that is not so important, but their values must be close to each other, like within a few percent. Now, if we plot this function, we see that it has two minima on the interval between 0 and 2 pi, and one minimum can represent the logical state 0, the other minimum can represent logical 1. So this device may be used as a qubit. It is important that the energy difference between the two minima is small. The energy difference, according to this function, equals 2 times J2. Why do we want it to be small? If it is not small by constant, it's OK. But generally, if there is some energy difference, it depends on external parameters. And if those external parameters fluctuate, the energy difference itself fluctuates. And this may cause decoherence of the qubit. However, if we manage to reduce this energy difference in some universal way, due to the universality, it will not depend on those external parameters either, and it will be coherent. How does one achieve that? Well, this is one idea. It's a chain of such devices. And this idea was proposed by Dussault and Vidal. And at the same time, Ioffe and Fegelman proposed a two-dimensional network of such rhombi, which also achieves protection, even stronger protection than in 1D. But this 1D thing is easier to understand. Suppose we have a chain of such rhombi. One can think of the state of each rhombus as a variable that takes values 0 and 1. It is the phase difference across each device in units of pi. And if we fix the external phases, suppose the difference between the external phases is 0, then we must have an even number of zeros. And in principle, we can have a quantum superposition of states with an even number of zeros. And if the phase difference across the whole chain is pi, we have an odd number of ones. So we have some superposition with an even number of ones to represent logical zero, and with an odd number of ones to represent logical one. Now, if there are quantum fluctuations, the phase at each island, for instance, this crossing point is an island of superconductor that is separated from the rest of the circuit by four Joyeux junctions. The phase on that island can flip. And when the phase flips, two symbols here change from 0 to 1 or from 1 to 0. But the sum remains invariant. And due to those flips, there'll be a superposition will form that has equal coefficients in front of each basis state. Suppose that the flip amplitude is t, or I call it tunneling amplitude also. It turns out that the interactions or the energy differences between 0 and 1 average out due to those quantum flips. And the average value is proportional to J2 over T. J2 is the asymmetry of a single device, and T is the tunneling amplitude. And this thing is raised to the power n minus 1, where n is the number of rhombi. So we have exponential protection. It is exponential in the length of the chain. And one can think of this as an error-correcting curve. It's a simple form of an error-correcting curve. Now, that device suggests that quantum protection requires a many-body system because a protected state is similar to a quantum curve. However, it is possible to achieve quantum protection with one continuous variable. In fact, in this paper with Daniel Gottesman and John Preskill, we constructed a code that encodes a qubit into a state of an oscillator, basically in a system with one continuous degree of freedom. And the device I'm going to present uses this idea. But the main idea of the new work is that a sufficiently large superconducting inductor is a very powerful thing. It can provide encoding or quantum protection using Joyeux junction and capacitors as supplementary devices. The idea is that when we have a large superconducting inductor, it's like a long wire. It has a phase changing along this wire. It's a continuous variable. And this variable can wind around the circle of 2 pi. It can wind around many times. But it's still continuous. And it's kind of topological protection in 1D. The winding number is kind of the
encoding topology. Usually, people do experiments on long conducting, superconducting wires. Sometimes it's like nanowires. And often they see metal insulated transitions.
Right.
So there's usually some dissipation.
Right.
By them. So how is that avoided in this case?
I'll come to that question later.
Okay.
I'll try to answer your question while talking. Let's set up some notation. We assume that the Planck constant is one, the charge of a Cooper is one. Then the resistance unit, which is h over 2 squared, which is in the usual unit units is 1 kilo, will be taken as one. So one resistance unit is just 1 kilo. Usually, this thing occurs in combination with 2 pi, so the quantum resistance that is relevant to most problems is 6 kilo ohms or 2 pi in the dimensionless units. Now let me consider an inductor. I want to derive some condition on the inductor to be useful for qubit design. This is just the harmonic oscillator, and the Hamiltonian has a potential energy phi squared over L. It's the potential energy, and there is a kinetic energy, which has the capacitance in the denominator. It's not possible to get rid of capacitance in any electric circuit, so we'll assume that there is some capacitance here. The derivative with respect to the derivative with respect to phase is charge. Charge and phase are dual variables.
And this phi squared over L, is it the expansion of the Jefferson energy or?
Oh, there is no Jefferson junction here. It's just a harmonic oscillator. The current is phi over L, the current through the inductor. Let's calculate the fluctuations of the phase. In this Hamiltonian, the phase is not defined modulo 2 pi. It's actually a real number. That's because the phase is continuous in this wire. The inductor is just a long wire, and the phase changes continuously. So we can think of it as a circle, and we're constructing the universal cover of this circle, which is a line. So the phase changes continuously. The average square of the phase is given by this formula. And the ratio L over C, and the square root of this ratio, has the dimension of resistance. It's called characteristic impedance of the LC circuit. And we want this number to be large in quantum units. Why do we want that? If this number is large, then this thing, e to the I phi average, will be small. It will be actually exponentially small. And this number defines the current of this LC circuit connected in series with this Jefferson junction. You'll see how this comes about in a different circuit later. So we want this number to be greater than 4 or 4 kilo ohms. And this condition is actually hard to achieve. If we make a coil, its characteristic impedance is proportional to the impedance of the vacuum times the number of loops in the coil and times this thing. But the impedance of the vacuum is 377 ohms, which is much smaller than the quantum impedance. It's smaller by the fine structure constant. To compensate for that, one could make many loops, but that would require a coil with like a few hundred loops, which is not very realistic on a microchip. Another way of making a large inductance is by connecting several adjacent junctions in series, but we also need too many junctions, so this is probably realistic, but not so easy to do. And it seems that the most realistic way to create a large inductor is using kinetic inductance. Kinetic inductance occurs when we have a dirty superconductor with very high resistance in normal state. High resistance in normal state translates to low density of superconducting electrons, rho s. And the inductance is proportional to the normal state resistance. Here, R with this symbol is the resistance per square. It's a two-dimensional film. In two dimensions, the resistivity and resistance are the same. I mean, they're expressed in the same units. Delta is in the denominator, the superconducting gap. And there is also a geometric factor, L over D. L is the length of the wire, and D is the width. We're making wire out of very thin film. The film is really thin, like 20 angstroms, very thin. The width of the film is macroscopic, maybe 1,000 angstroms or 100 nanometers. For kinetic inductance, the geometric capacitance can be neglected. It's usually small. And the phase fluctuations depend on this resistance in the normal state times the geometric factor. So the phase fluctuation is proportional to the resistance in the quantum units. So we want this number to be large. So we require that the aspect ratio is much greater than this combination. And the resistance per square can be of the order of a few kiloohms in an amorphous material. So we need a very dirty superconductor. And there are a few examples like molybdenum germanium where this condition is achieved. One condition is this, and the other condition is important to prevent phase slips and eventually to prevent the superconducting insulator transition. In a wire like that, a vortex can go across, and that would be a phase slip. The phase becomes no longer continuous, but a variable defined modulo 2 pi. And this leads to a superconducting insulator transition. So we want to prevent that. And for that, the width of the wire must be much greater than the coherence length. The coherence length in amorphous materials is rather small. It can be like 30 angstroms. And the actual width can be 1,000 angstroms. So the probability of a phase slip will be exponential in the ratio of the two. So it can be pretty small. There will be practically no phase slips. Here is a typical application of an inductor. It's an inductor connected in series with a Joseon junction, which has some built-in capacitance. And the Joseon junction is characterized by J and C. There is a dimensionless ratio, the square root of J times C. And let's assume that this ratio is of the order of unity. If it's large, the junction is in the superconducting regime, Joseon regime. If it's small, then the Coulomb energy dominates the dynamics. But we want them to be of the same order. The typical energy scale is the Joseon plasma frequency, which is given by the square root of J over C. It's typically 20 gigahertz or 1 Kelvin in aluminum oxide junctions. And one can also estimate the geometric capacitance, which is not very large if we consider small devices. Here is the basic application of a superinductor, a very large inductor. It's an adiabatic switch. It consists of an inductor in series with a squid. A squid is basically a tunable Joseon junction. If we put some magnetic flux through the effective Driftson coupling changes according to this formula. And we assume that the superconducting phase theta is fixed on the right-hand side. Here it's also fixed at zero. But in the middle, it fluctuates. And the quantum fluctuations will determine the energy of the device. The energy, of course, depends on theta. So we have some function E of theta, and when we take the derivative, we get the average current. And this average current can be changed by changing the Jevons junction. So how do we calculate this current? We're interested in the maximal current, or critical current, when theta is about pi over 2. To solve this problem, we must write some Hamiltonian. Here is the model Hamiltonian. It has this term, pi squared over L, which is the potential energy of the inductor. It has the Jevons energy that depends on the phase difference across the Jevons junction. And it also has kinetic energy. The kinetic energy has the charge operator, d over d phi, minus some quantity that is called offset charge. It turns out that when one makes a Jevons junction, the equilibrium number of Cooper pairs is not integer. It depends on some impurities in the Jevons junctions, and actually it's not known what it depends on, but it's known that it's basically a random uniformly distributed variable in the range between 0 and 1. Only the fractional charge of this number is important, and this fractional charge is randomly uniformly distributed as the device is manufactured. But once it's manufactured, it stays constant, more or less, at low temperatures. And here is the dependence on the critical current on J obtained by solving this Hamiltonian. So there are two regions. One region is called off when the critical current is small, the switch is off. The other region is called on when the critical current is rather large. How do we estimate the maximal current? Maximal current is given by pi over L. And this can be understood as follows. When J is large, then this term is large, and it locks phi and theta. But theta is defined modulo 2 pi. Phi is defined like a real variable. So phi must be equal to theta modulo 2 pi. Well, if we vary theta between minus pi and pi, it turns out that the energy minimum is achieved when phi equals theta. When theta grows larger than pi, then phi jumps. But in the range between minus pi and pi, these two guys are equal. And we just look at the potential energy, and this is how the maximal current is found. The minimal current is found as follows. When the Jevons junction is weak, we basically have an LC circuit. Remember that we had a similar Hamiltonian before. It has a potential energy and kinetic energy. Now, we also have potential energy and kinetic energy. And we just need to average this term to obtain the average energy, because now it can be treated as perturbation. And doing this calculation, we find that the average of this term depends exponentially on the phase fluctuation, phi squared average, which is exponentially small in the parameter gamma. Gamma is the characteristic impedance of the LC circuit. So we see that the current changes by a factor that is exponential in gamma. If we actually calculate the range over which this change occurs, It turns out that this range or window is not very wide. It's only logarithmically wide in gamma. So the effect is, in a sense, doubly exponential. The variation of the current is exponential, and the variation of the parameter is logarithmic. Of course, there are some numerical constants involved, and I don't know what they are. So in practice, it may turn out not to be so excellent, but still, in the asymptotic limit, it should be very good. How does this switch work? Here is the blue line is the plot of the potential energy that has parabolic potential phi squared over L. It's due to the inductor. And it has some oscillating potential. The green plot shows the density, the probability density, the square of the wave function. The system wants to be in one of those local minima. So the system is locked in local minima, but it still can travel. And depending on the barrier height, the tunneling strength changes exponentially. If the tunneling amplitude is large, it gives the system sufficiently large kinetic energy. It can swing across a large region in phi. If the barriers become high, then the kinetic energy is suppressed, and the system tends to be localized near zero. So these are the two pictures. When the switch is off, it means that the tunneling amplitudes through those barriers are sufficiently large, and the system has a wave function like that, shown by green.
If the
switch
is not
theta? It's a function of theta. Oh.
Not symmetric with respect to phi equals zero.
Yeah, it's theta. It's theta. When theta changes, the whole thing shifts. By the way, if you estimate how the energy changes depending on theta, the energy variation is exponentially small in this case. Those wiggles average out of this wide range. And when the switch is on, the system is localized near zero, actually near theta modulo 2 pi. The phase phi is locked to theta. Now, I have a couple of slides with calculations, but I'm not sure if you want to see all the details. The most important thing is this. The tunneling amplitude in the limit when mu is j times c is large is given by this formula. And this tunneling amplitude defines the kinetic energy, and basically it defines the transition between locked and unlocked states when the switch is on and when the switch is off. Okay, so we have one basic device, an adiabatic switch that changes between superconductor to insulator, in some sense. Now we can use the same idea for more complicated circuits. This circuit operates as a current mirror with 1-to-1 ratio, or one can say that it is a DC transformer. There are four terminals. We assume that the phase on the right-hand side is zero. Here the phases are theta 1 and theta 2. There are two internal points that are connected by Jacobson junctions. And there is a large capacitor here. Here is the condition on the capacitance C1. It's much greater than C, but only by a logarithmic factor in gamma. And here is the Hamiltonian. Phi plus and phi minus are the symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations of the two phases. And if one writes this Hamiltonian, one can see that the symmetric mode has a small effective capacitance, basically the capacitance of the junctions. And the anti-symmetric mode has a large effective capacitance, 2C1. C1 is this capacitor. And it can be tuned to be sufficiently large. So we have different dynamics for the symmetric and anti-symmetric mode. Now, of course, one can solve this Hamiltonian exactly or using some numerics, not very complicated. But qualitatively, things are rather simple. Suppose the anti-symmetric mode is tuned in such a way that the corresponding phase fluctuations are fast. That corresponds to the situation where we just have one inductor and one Jacobson junction. It's basically this part of the Hamiltonian, Q plus squared plus phi plus squared. It's a schematic for the symmetric mode. And this is like a switch, and the switch is off. No current flows in the symmetric mode. On the other hand, if the capacitance C1 is large, then in the anti-symmetric mode, we have a circuit that works as a closed switch, a switch that is completely connected. So in the symmetric mode, in the anti-symmetric mode, some current can flow. What does it mean? If there is current in the anti-symmetric channel, it means that there are two currents. On the top, the current goes this way, and on the bottom, the current goes that way, and they're equal in magnitude. So the currents are as shown here. We have two outgoing currents and two incoming currents, and they are all equal in magnitude. And the fact that the currents are equal also means that the voltages are equal, because there is no dissipation in the device. It works as a transformer. Now, one can deduce some properties of the energy function using the fact that the device works as a transformer. The energy function is a function of two variables, theta 1 and theta 2. More generally, it can be written as a function of four variables, the phases on the four terminals. And the currents are obtained by differentiating this function with respect to the corresponding variables. So the main term is this combination of the phases, theta 1 minus theta 2 plus theta 3 minus theta 4. And there is some correction or an error term which is small. It is exponentially small in the parameter gamma. So we have this effective Hamiltonian with an exponentially small correction. This is a very important result for a qubit design. Now, we turn the current mirror into a qubit. This is very, very simple. We just connect the terminals diagonally. So we assume that theta 1 equals theta 3 because they're connected by a wire. It's a superconducting wire. And also theta 2 equals theta 4. So
now, can current flow now in the device?
Now there is no net current.
Right, because you block the
exactly.
current.
Yeah,
and the
right.
Current right.
Yes, exactly. The current cannot flow. But there is still no non-trivial Hilbert space for the
function of theta 1 minus theta 2.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Since theta 1 minus theta 2 is the only parameter now, we can write the energy as a function of that. And if we go back, we have this function that depends on four phases. Now we substitute theta 1 for theta 3 and theta 2 for theta 4. And we get two times this phase difference. So f is some function that is periodic with period 2 pi. When we have 2 times the phase difference, it means that the energy is periodic with period pi in the phase difference. And it means that there are 2 energy minima that are equal. They have the same energy up to this error term, which is exponentially small. So we can store a0 and a1 using the state where theta1 minus theta2 are equal to 0 and pi respectively.
Is there any physical meaning to the derivative of E with respect to the state difference?
Because
we have the units of current. But,
yeah, well, in the average, the phase difference will be 0. I mean, in the average, the system will stay in one of those minima. If we want to calculate the tunneling dynamics, then of course we need to know the slope of this curve, because it will determine the tunneling dynamics.
But suppose that you put the system at some value of theta.
Okay.
Then there is a slope.
Yes.
Does this slope correspond to some measurable quantity?
Yes, yes. Of course, if you connect one wire to one point in an external circuit and the other wire to some other point, there'll be some there will be some net current for the device. You can measure this function when you fix those phases by hand.
There will be a current which will be symmetric.
Yes, yes, yes. Both currents will go in here and there, and they will go out of those points. The distribution will be symmetrical. Actually, it is very important to suppress tunneling between 0 and 1. By the previous argument, we know that the phase error is suppressed because the energy difference between 0 and 1 is small. But the qubit flip error may still be large. It turns out that the qubit flip error is determined by this parameter, actually by the square root of that. But that's assuming that there are no phase slips in the inductors. If there are phase slips in the inductors, the estimate is worse. So we better have good inductors without phase slips. And the phase slips in this device can be further suppressed by connecting 2, 3 or more such devices in parallel. This will work better than a single device with large C1. But this is just a complication. Now, let me show the application, a possible application of this device. Here is the same device, basically. It's the transformer connected by two pieces of wire diagonally. And if you think about the topology, let's forget about this circuit and this connection. We only have 4 nodes that are connected by 6 edges. 2 edges are inductors, 2 edges are capacitors, and 2 edges are Josephson junctions. In this circuit, they are tunable. So we basically have a tetrahedron where 2 opposite edges are capacitors, 2 opposite edges are inductors, and 2 opposite edges are Josephson junctions. And one can draw this circuit in many different ways. Here is one way that is particularly convenient for the discussion of measurements. We take the middle point of one inductor and connect it to the ground. The other middle point will be connected through an adiabatic switch to some measurement circuit that can measure either current or voltage. And we also have this Josephson junction tunable. The system can be in 3 different states. The first state is quiet. It's the state of a qubit that doesn't interact with anything. And in this state, those junctions must be on so that the qubit operates as discussed before. But the output junction must be off. The switch is off. So the qubit is disconnected from the measuring circuit. If we want to measure the phase difference, we know that there are two answers, zero or pi. What do we do? Of course, we connect the device to the measuring circuit. Now, the phase here is fixed, either zero or pi. The phase here may change depending on how the circuit is arranged. And if we put some magnetic flux through this loop, say we've put magnetic flux pi over 2, then there will be some net current that can be measured. So when this switch is on, we can measure the phase using a current measurement. However, there's one problem which may turn to be difficult to overcome. The current will be rather small. And if you estimate it in a realistic situation, it is smaller than the temperature. So this measurement should not be an equilibrium measurement, because if we let the system equilibrate, then the current will be zero. And still, I think that it's not so big a problem, because when this the qubit is in the quiet state, there is a certain ground state, which is separated by a gap that may be larger than the temperature. Only when we do the measurement, we have that problem. And by doing some smart measurement out of equilibrium, it may be possible to distinguish between the two states. So,
could you say which loop the flux flies through?
It's the ground loop. It goes through the device, through the measuring circuit, and to the ground.
All right. So it's inside that box with the two Josephs?
No. Phi stays here, where it's drawn. So the loop is here. But of course, you can put this phi in here, and it will be, half of the flux will go through this loop, and half of the flux will go through that small loop. Okay, the output current is given by 1 over L. This is a rather small number. If we want to do a dual measurement, dual means that we measure in this basis 0 plus 1 over the square root of 2, the symmetric state and the antisymmetric state. What are these states? One might say that in a certain sense, this device is just a capacitor, because there is no net current for it. This capacitor is formed by two copies of by two capacitors in the circuit itself, and there is some charge on this capacitor. The charge actually fluctuates, because it can go through the Josephson junctions or through the inductors. But it turns out that the fractional charge, the fractional part of the charge, is conserved up to exponential precision. And those two states differ in the fractional part of the charge. One may say that the fractional part of the charge here is 0, and here it's 1/2. Actually, there is also some offset charge, which needs to be taken into account. But still, the statement is true that the fractional part of the charge differs by 1/2 over Cooper curve for these two states. We need to do some charge measurement, and this charge measurement may be done by turning these Jacobson junctions off. When the Jacobson junctions are on, the fractional charge is constant, of course, but the integer part fluctuates wildly. And the average charge in both states is the same. It's very difficult to measure. That's why the device works. If we turn J off, then the average charge will also be non-zero, and it can induce some voltage in here. Now, those junctions are off, and this junction is also off. However, it has some capacitance, and there'll be some induced voltage at this point, which can in principle be measured. Again, this voltage is rather small. It's given by 1 over C1. So there are two small parameters that need to be measured. But otherwise, I don't see any problem with this circuit. I mean, in the quiet state, it's protected exponentially. And it does have the ability to turn into a state where interaction is possible. Okay, thank you for your attention.